I'm Christopher Lydon with my tutor and conscience on the environmental crisis, Bill McKibben, the writer and activist. The premise of his new book called Earth is that the Earthrise the astronauts photographed from the moon 40 years ago is gone. Now what? This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Bill, your emphasis on that Earthrise picture reminds me of something E.O. Wilson said many years ago. He said, the biomass of the human beings in that film of life around the globe is about equal to the biomass of all the ants on the planet. If we took the people out of that layer, it would be safe forever. If we took the ants out, it would be doomed to a very early death. Here we are, us people, screwing it up still. Remind us how it's changed in just those 40 years.
Well, you know, that image of EDS is a perfect one to begin with. Because it is astonishing. How could that tiny biomass of human beings, even though there's now 6 billion of us viewed from outer space, it's not very much. How could we actually have changed something as big as the planet? And the answer is, we found beneath the ground immense quantities of ancient biology, hundreds of millions of years of ferns and dinosaur and plankton that's now natural gas and oil and coal. We burned it all, or a lot of it already. And the carbon, the CO2 from that ancient biology had a particular property. Its molecular structure traps heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. And so in our lifetimes, we've seen suddenly that Earth, which for 10,000 years of human civilization, the period we call the Holocene, had been very stable and by our lights very benign, we see it suddenly changing in remarkable ways. So far, human beings have raised the temperature of the planet 1 degree. Now, 20 years ago, when I wrote The End of Nature, the first book about all this, we wouldn't have thought that 1 degree was enough to really knock things deep askew. We would have thought it was taking us to the edge of global warming, but not over the edge. Turns out that we were wrong. 1 degree, 2 watts per square meter of extra energy in the Earth's surface was enough, because the planet was very finely balanced, to start doing quite dramatic things. Everything frozen on that Earth is melting now. Okay, the atmosphere, because warm air holds more water vapor than cold, is about 5% wetter than it was 40 years ago. That's an astonishing change in a basic physical parameter of the Earth. It means, among other things, that we see incredible downpours, flooding all over the world. I mean, ask an engineer. The 100-year storm comes every 3 or 4 years in a lot of places. Even things that were much too big to change, that we never could have changed. The oceans that cover 3/4 of the Earth's surface and where we live not, even those we've managed to shift in remarkable ways. Because that seawater is absorbing carbon from the atmosphere, it's become about 30% more acid, and it's starting to interfere dramatically with the ability of marine organisms to reproduce. So that picture from those first Apollo missions that kind of taught us that we were living on a beautiful blue-white marble floating through the black,
man,
empty void of space, you know.
That
picture is as out of date as, you know, my high school yearbook photo. It doesn't look like that anymore. It's kind of the reverse of my high school yearbook photo, because I have more white up top and it has less, you know. But
Bill,
it's a very different place.
Especially for us news people, is that we compartmentalize everything. We read the disaster stories, and we experience these, I mean, in New England, these astonishing thundershowers. I mean, like torrential floods, and they're over in a moment, but we don't connect them.
So, you know, two years ago it was New Hampshire flooded out, you know, in that corner of New Hampshire, and canceling schools for weeks on end. Summer of 2008, it was my home state of Vermont, you know, the greatest downpours ever recorded. 3 weeks ago, it was Rhode Island suddenly finding itself
underwater. You know, you could take a boat around the mall. Meanwhile, the same thing happening last week in Rio de Janeiro, you know.
But very, very few of us, Bill, connect the dots.
Well, that's
or
why
see
we
a
have,
continuum. Or
that's why we have books, you know, and
well, that's why
and
we
writers.
Have Bill McKibben.
That's right.
Other instances, please, of the evidence that something big is underway.
Sure. Pretty much name a physical feature of the planet. Take the great boreal forests that dominate the northern hemisphere across, say, North America. We've lost now tens of millions of acres of pine trees. Not a pine tree left. For you get a places up in a plain, and you horizon to horizon, there's not a living tree, because the pine bark beetle that had always been there and had always killed a few trees, but forever was kept in check by cold winter temperatures, no longer has those cold winter temperatures to contend with. Last winter was the warmest winter ever recorded in Canada. And hence, they're spreading almost literally like wildfire. And in their wake comes actual wildfire. As those dead trees burn, when they burn, they put a whole new plume of carbon into the atmosphere. Forest fire season across the West, which used to be confined to the, you know, warmest, driest months of the year, 3 or 4 months of the year, now stretches from March to whenever snow finally falls in the fall. The number of fires goes up just astonishingly. The great storms that circulate across the bands, the stormy bands around the middles of the earth, are more powerful than they've ever been, because, of course, they draw their power from the heat in the first few meters of the Earth's surface. So we see astonishing storms, Katrina being one example, but by no means the only one. Last summer, the chain of typhoons that marched across Asia was a sight to behold. One stalled for 3 days over the mountains of Taiwan, and before it was gone, there were villages there that had received 9.5 feet of rain. I mean, needless to say, those villages are no longer there, but those kind of things are happening on a new Earth. Now, there are people out there who don't trust scientists. I'm not sure why, but they don't. Those people should go consult with insurance people for a while,
right?
You know, because they're having more trouble than anybody else. Their basic tool, the actuarial table, one of the great technologies human beings ever came up with, an instrument that allows us to deal with risk by predicting it and hence being able to hedge against it. The actuarial table depends completely on the world of the future behaving pretty much as the world behaves in the past. That bet is off, and that's why you all of a sudden can't get homeowner insurance across much of the Gulf. You have to go to the state as the insurer of last resort, you know. Those kind of changes are already claiming lots of lives around the world, as we see mosquitoes come into huge bands of the planet where they weren't 10, 15 years ago, much less hundreds or thousands of years ago when those places and cities were settled and formed. Those kind of changes are what happened with 1 degree of temperature increase. We're almost certainly committed to at least 2 degrees because of the carbon we've already put in the atmosphere. If we don't get to work with incredible assiduousness, then we're looking at 4, 5, 6, 7 degrees in the course of this century. I called this book Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H. By the time the century
pronounce
is
it.
Done, we're gonna, well, I always say you got to pronounce it like Schwarzenegger, you know, it's going to be Earth. But by the time the century is done, if we're not careful, it'll be, you know, 6 A's long. It'll be Earth. It'll bear no resemblance whatsoever to the planet.
The Terminator, indeed.
That's
Bill, it. Beyond the industrial self-interest of ExxonMobil, say, or lots of other people who are invested in growth today, what is the human problem in not seeing the trouble ahead?
Well, first of all, don't skip over too lightly the industrial self-interest of Exxon at all. This is the
I don't.
This is the most profitable enterprise human beings have ever come up with, by far. Okay? I mean, Exxon alone made more money each of the last 3 years than any company in the history of money. Okay? And they've used a not insignificant portion of that, the entire industry, to disinform and confuse people. That's made it harder to take action, and it plays easily, you know, their strategy, because none of us really want to take action. There's an enormous amount of inertia that comes from the fact that present arrangements are what we're used to, and change, as always, seems difficult. So in a political system where all you have to do is delay, where fighting off change is remarkably easy, they've had an easier task than those of us who are trying to get change to happen.
This is the question. In a world where we've seen Al Gore's movie, we've felt the high winds, we've experienced the inertia of Copenhagen, we've watched the Congress absolutely stuck in the old ways, what's to do, Bill McKibben?
The only thing to do is, and it's somewhat of a long shot, is to build a political movement big enough to change that political reality. That's what we're trying to do. Chris, I've spent the last couple of years less as a writer and more as a volunteer activist. We've formed this group, 350.org. The number comes from Jim Hansen at NASA, our greatest climatologist. His team said 350 parts per million CO2 was the most carbon you could safely have in the atmosphere if you wanted a planet similar to the one on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. And we took that number, 350. We didn't have any money or anything, but we started campaigning around the world. When I say we, me and seven kids who had just graduated from Middlebury College, where I'm connected, we spent a year and a half finding people like us around the world. It turned out we found a lot of them. Last October 24th, we staged this day of action that featured 5,200 simultaneous demonstrations in 181 countries, pretty much everything that wasn't North Korea. I mean, CNN called it the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. So there are people out there working hard for change. It's going to be a race to see if we can build any kind of political constituency for serious change while we still have time, not any longer, to stop global warming. As I make clear in the book, that possibility is done. But try to prevent it from getting any worse than it absolutely has to get.
Bill, pull apart the we. How many of those are Americans? How many of those are Bangladeshis, you know, about to be flooded?
It's easy for you to go check it out, because there are pictures of all 5,200 of the 25,000 pictures in our Flickr account. But if you go to 350.org, you can look at them. And what you'll find is that the old canard that environmentalism is a kind of hobby for affluent white people who have gotten rid of their other problems is a lie. Almost everybody in those pictures is poor, black, brown, Asian, young. Because that's what almost everybody on this planet is, you know?
It's the only hope, let's face it.
We have files full of, you know, 100 demonstrations that are all women in full burqas, you know? We have every kind of human being that you can imagine united around an obscure scientific data point, 350 parts per million, and scrambling like hell for their future. And it's really exciting to see. We're doing something kind of like it this October, October 10th, 10-10-10. We're having what we call a global work party. And there will be people in thousands of places all over the world putting up solar panels, digging gardens, laying out bike paths, not on the theory that this is how we're going to address global warming, that we're not going to do it one bike path at a time. That math doesn't work. We'll only do it if we get serious action that puts a serious price on carbon. But the point of doing all this, beyond building a lot of good, useful bike paths, is that we'll be able to send a piquant political message, I hope. And that message is, we're getting to work. What about you? You know, if I can climb up on the roof and hammer in a solar panel, perhaps you could climb to the floor of the Senate and hammer out a little legislation. Perhaps you could try a little harder than the pathetic showing put in our national capital and many others.
We'll come back to the bike paths in this country. Mm-hmm. But first, I mean, how do black, brown, and yellow poor people get and act on the message that we in ways that we don't?
Well, because they can see the – I mean, Americans do. We had 1,000 of these demonstrations across the U.S. too. I mean, there are plenty of people here who do. But it's easier in places where it's already pinching. We're insulated by our wealth from some of this change. So, you know, I have my town, as described in the book, my town in Vermont had the single two worst rainstorms in its history, 6 weeks apart in the summer of 2008. We lost our road. We almost lost our town. We were cut off from the world. And the governor had to come in a helicopter, everything you're kind of used to from these scenes. But we had $2 million that the federal government came up with to rebuild the road to the top of the hill. When that happens in the Congo, nobody appears with $2 million to rebuild the road. People just live where they now are cut off even more than they were before. So it didn't, I mean, on the one hand, it completely amazed us to have all these pictures pouring in from the Congo. We, you know, amazed us to have 15,000 people in the street in Addis Ababa or 10,000 in Bujumbura and Burundi or whatever. On the other hand, it didn't amaze us because, you know, without the insulation that wealth provides, the effects of this kind of change are already easily apparent. You know, when you live in a place where all of a sudden people are dying of a brand new disease to that place, dengue fever, this mosquito-borne disease spreading like wildfire around the world, it, you know, you don't have to be an, quote, environmentalist. If you're someone who's interested in health, in human rights, in issues of war and peace, if you're someone who's just interested in your country having any kind of future, we have pictures in there that'll break your heart of, you know, people in Bangladeshi T-shirt factories stopping at their sewing machines where they're making, you know, 40 cents a day to hold up banners that they'd sewn to, you know, try and make this point.
What bugs me in this country is especially Tom Friedman, the ideology of a new kind of corporate contest here to be more muscular, more American, more nationalistic, more profitable than ever in a kind of greening of the world.
This sort of butch environmentalism, yes.
That we're, is that what it is?
That we're headed towards. No, absolutely. Look, it's a nice fantasy that we would just keep the machine going just as it's going, but rip out the internal combustion engine and toss in a solar panel and, you know, on we would fly. I don't think it's realistic one. I think, among other things, it just completely ignores the physical difference between fuels. I mean, fossil fuel was the most important thing about modernity. It's what modernity was. It describes why we live, how we live. Okay, it's dense. It's rich in BTUs, concentrated in a few places, easy to get at and easy to transport. It made sense that we would use it to centralize a lot of things, you know, build huge power stations that beamed energy out to us or whatever. That's not the world we're moving into. The kind of energy we can afford to use, sun and wind and things, is very different. It's omnipresent, but it's diffuse. It's dispersed. But the logic that goes with it is almost exactly the opposite logic. Now, we've got to, you can almost taste that by thinking about analogies. You know, you've spent your life in broadcasting, and when you started, it was a few centralized institutions beaming out a very few messages.
Now, 22 minutes of Walter Cronkite telling you that's the way
it is,
Chris Lydon.
Now, it's diffuse and dispersed. It's like a farmer's market in information. Well, we need a farmer's market in electrons and a farmer's market in food. We need that spread out in a world where friction is growing. We need to figure out how to spread out and become stable and resilient, and part of that's being smaller. You know, think about the last 3 years. What's the most important phrase of the last 3 years? If you ask me, it's got to be too big to fail, you know? It wasn't just our banks that were too big to fail. I mean, much worse than that is our food system and our energy system. If they go, you know, then we're in much deeper trouble. They're just as centralized, just as deeply linked, and just as shaky as the banks ever were. And that's why it's, you know, encouraging that we're at least beginning to think about how we might build down those things.
What are you telling us, Bill McKibben, about the very ideology of growth? Growth for the sake of growth, as somebody said years ago, the ideology of the cancer cell.
Ed Abbey, my old friend Ed Abbey was, I think.
Was that his line?
I think it was his line. Look, growth has been how we've solved every problem that we've faced for a long time. It's helped us avoid having to make hard choices of any kind, because the answer is always, let's just have some more so we don't have to worry about how we divide it up or, you know, anything else. But we've run into those limits to growth. When the ocean is suddenly turning to acid, I mean, that's a poor sign about how things are going, you know? It's a pretty good signal that it's time to figure out some other approach. That's a moment that we should have been able to tell was going to come some point. You know, we're a finite planet, so hence the idea of endless growth was probably not all that great to begin with. We just happen to be alive at the moment when it comes, you know? The music's stopping. There aren't an endless number of chairs. So now we've got to figure out what we're going to do.
Bill, how many people are there on your new planet?
Oh, I don't have any, you know, I don't have any, like, vision of exactly how the world should look or what it's going to look like.
Yeah, but
I'm interested in trajectories. So population is one of those interesting questions. I mean, it's the one that we kind of got right, you know. The fertility curve finally broke. People did great work around the world. They figured out what you had to do. If you educated women and empowered them a little, then they'd have many fewer children. As a result, the average woman 30 years ago had 6 kids. That number's 2.6 now and falling still. The human population's going to go up, you know, another 25 or 30%, and then that's just because of the age distribution now in play. But then it's going to level off and then decline. That's not the scary upward curve. The scary upward curve is the consumption one, and we haven't figured out yet how to make that one break. That's what we've got to do.
Measure it. Consumption of what? Gasoline,
well,
above all?
Yeah, I mean, it starts energy? With... I mean, fossil fuel works as a good proxy at the moment for consumption of everything, because everything is implicated in, you know, everything involves the use of fossil fuel. I mean, food is a good example. So consumption of meat, you know, consumption of mobility, be it via car, via jet plane, via whatever, consumption in this country of, I mean, what's our economy been about for 50 years? It's been about building bigger houses farther apart from each other. So consumption of square footage and acreage, on and on and on. These are all things that are unsustainable, and they have in common the fact that they're expressions of a kind of hyper-individualism that's come to mark our high consumer society. The antidote to them, if there is one, in the same way that empowering women was the antidote to endless fertility growth, the antidote to this, if there is one, is figuring out how to build stronger communities that require less of that kind of individual consumption and provide satisfaction in a lot of other ways.
Bill, what does the internet do for this game?
Boy, that's an interesting question. The internet really offers you at least the possibility to stay in one place, lead a very local life, and yet be deeply connected to the rest of the planet, to have a window open all the time so that new ideas are blowing in, old ones blowing out. I mean, why'd you call this program open source, you know? It's the kind of thing we taught ourselves at 350.org when we started, because we had no money. We were resource constrained, limited. We weren't going to arrange a march on Washington. Also because it seemed foolish to tell people to drive across America to protest climate change, you know. We thought that the architecture of the world was different. We thought that now it was possible to do things in thousands of places at once and make them add up to something more than the sum of their parts. And they did. For 36 hours last October, we owned Google News. We were the most linked to story in the entire world, you know, all about this number and this, you know, thing that was the same all over the world. But we didn't need to be in one centralized place to make it happen.
That's fascinating. I fell in love with the social architecture, the global connection of the internet. Almost 10 years ago, around the time of the start of the Iraq War, a friend of mine called it the second superpower rearing its beautiful head of organizing people. It didn't stop the war in Iraq. Maybe this is another chance.
This, I hope, is another chance. It didn't stop the war in Iraq because that was, as we know by now, completely predetermined. You know, there was no stopping it. This plays out in slightly slower time. So maybe there's the chance to build the kind of movement that we need. It's still going to be a real political movement. It's going to have to look like the one that, you know, allowed us to win the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and all those things. But we're going to have to use what tools we have.
In the short term, Bill McKibben, it seems that when people are worried desperately about 10% unemployment, they're willing to put aside the evidence or believe the counter stories about the environment. What's to do?
Look, this is the test of, I mean, in some ways, not to be overly dramatic, this is the test of whether the big brain was a smart adaptation or not, you know? We know that it can get us into large amounts of trouble. Now we're going to find out if it can get us out. And one of the things that we will find out is whether we're just constitutionally capable of dealing with the slightly more long term. I mean, even environmentalists are the same way. Mm. So right now we're transfixed by these pictures from the Gulf of Mexico of oil spreading in this slick across the Gulf. And it's horrible to look at, all right? And it'll have horrible effects. But they're nothing compared to the profound effects of the invisible slick of acid that's spreading across the ocean for the last 30 years because it's absorbing so much carbon. I mean, that's getting at the basic ability of the marine food chain to keep going, you know? Whether or not we can bring ourselves to see the slightly lower, slightly slower, slightly larger things that are happening in the background, I don't know. If you were a betting person, you might well bet we're not going to get a hold of this. But that does not strike me as a bet that we're allowed to make, you know. Our job is to figure out how to change those odds some, and so that's what we're trying to do.
Bill McKibben, last question for me is China, a proxy also for all sorts of nightmares, all sorts of hopes. Coal pollution, population explosion, population control, and now clean technology. What's the McKibben line on China?
Well, look, think about how hard this is for China. We come at this question after 200 years of rapid growth that brought us a prosperity the world's never seen, you know. The Chinese hit this same limit to growth after 15 years of rapid growth. In a country that still has 700 million people living in bitter rural poverty. Mm. By far the easiest way for them to get out of that, the cheapest way, is to do what we did. Keep burning the mountains of cheap coal that they have lying all over their country. You know? But they've come to understand two things. One, that they're even more screwed by climate change than we are. I mean, look, they already have great problems with aridity. The water table is, I mean, they're in such dire water shortage that they're diverting the southern rivers to flow into the north, you know, building a 1,000-mile-long canal. Those rivers in the first place depend on the now melting glaciers of the Himalayas. The Pearl River Delta, which is where most of their manufacturing is built, is a few meters above sea level. They're very concerned about climate change. And they've sort of determined, I think, that as a consolation prize for not getting to develop the way that they were planning to, they're going to own the green energy industry going forward. So they're making big leaps. They're ready to make a deal with us. We're not ready to make a deal. That was what was clear at Copenhagen. Obama's been unwilling to commit significant political capital to this question.
Well, forgive me, but what would the deal look like?
The deal would look like we're all of us agreeing on some kind of mechanism to ramp the price of carbon fuels up year after year after year, far into the future, so that every investment decision made now, both corporate and personal, would be made knowing that fossil fuel was no longer a viable option for the future.
Mm.
And that would be enough, we hope, to spur change at the speed and on the scale that we need.
It would depend. And who's holding out? Why?
Well, I mean, why? ExxonMobil is the most profitable company in the world. There are people making immense amounts of money off the current way of doing things. And in our political system, that's been enough to allow them to block action. I mean, there seems to be maybe one Republican vote for an incredibly weak climate bill that John Kerry's been trying to bring before the Senate. It's a bill that's so weak it probably isn't even worth doing because it's filled with giveaways, including the shameful concession on endless offshore drilling around this country. But at any event, I mean, it's not even close to passing. Our country hasn't proved mature enough to deal with reality yet. We're big addicts. And, you know enough about addicts to know what that problem's like, you know. Until you face what's going on, nothing happens.
Last little question. What would E.O. Wilson's ant colonies do, sensing somehow a threat to the whole environment?
You're going to have to ask Ed. They would send out some kind of interesting, you know, pheromone, and half of them would turn in from workers to something else, and it would all work out. That's not going to happen to us. We're going to have to think our way out of this problem, and we'll see.
Bill, we should talk much more often. I regard you as an indispensable guide to, as you say, reality.
And I regard you as an indispensable guide to all kinds of things, and I'm incredibly grateful that you took the time this afternoon to do this.
Bill, I thank you. Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.